You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
I think what I'll do is offer just a very, very brief overview of ARIO's service and the case, and then go pretty quickly to questions for the panel. For those of you who haven't followed it closely, ARIO is a service that was designed to enable people to receive their local free over-the-air broadcast stations over the Internet for a monthly subscription rate that would be substantially less than their typical monthly cable bill. To provide that service, ARIO came up with a system that uses a large number of very tiny individual mini antennas, so that the way the system worked from a technical perspective is that each user who wants to watch broadcast stations over the Internet is temporarily assigned a very small antenna of their own, which pulls down the broadcast signal, makes a copy of the program for that user, and then streams it over the Internet to that user. ARIO set up its service that way, probably primarily for legal reasons. Copyright law says that to publicly perform a work requires permission, but to privately perform a work does not. And there was a 2008 case that ARIO was trying to rely on involving Cablevision's remote DVR, which had said that when a service lets users stream their own copies of a program back to themselves, that could qualify as a private rather than public performance. So fast forward to the Supreme Court case.
No permission is required to have an antenna. We shouldn't have to have any permission to run this service. On the other hand, ARIO's opponent said, no, actually, ARIO is really the equivalent of a cable service. Cable services, after all, have a big antenna from which they pull down broadcast signals and then transmit broadcast programming over cables to individuals' homes. And they said that looks exactly like what ARIO is doing. Well, the Supreme Court looked at this and sided with ARIO's opponents. It said that ARIO is the essential equivalent of a cable system, and that really seemed to be the key to the ruling. The court traced through the history of legal treatment of cable systems and noted that Congress has said that cable systems do need permission, and the court said that that was basically determinative. ARIO looks like a cable system, and therefore they need permission in order to publicly perform, and hence ARIO loses. So that's a brief introduction to where things are. What I think I might do is start with some relatively narrow questions about what this means for television and for ARIO, and then we'll move to the broader questions of what this means for other internet kinds of services. So as I said, the court ruling was really based on its finding that ARIO bore, in the court's words, an overwhelming resemblance to cable. And I guess my first question is, so does that kind of look like cable rule provide a reasonably clear standard for the television industry? Will it foster legitimate competition? Sandra, if we could start with you, maybe you could tell us why this outcome was important from the perspective of broadcasters and creators of television programs, and what it means for the development of the legitimate marketplace in that area.
Sure, thanks. So I think even though the court did look to cable as a model and analogized to cable in its analysis in the decision, I think it's a mistake to say this is a looks-like-cable kind of analysis in its entirety. I think what the court was really doing was coming out with a strong and articulate and focused decision that just takes a very straightforward technology-neutral approach that confirms that regardless of the device or process that you use to communicate a work to the public, the authors of the work should be compensated for that work. And I think that's a very positive result, not just for creators of copyrighted works, but for consumers and for tech startups. I think it's important that you take a tech-neutral approach to the law because it ensures that there's a level playing field among new market entrants and existing market entrants. This is really kind of buzzing a bit. it means that you're not enabling courts and Congress to pick winners and losers in the marketplace, but that everybody basically plays under the same set of rules, and that courts and Congress don't have to foresee every little twist and turn in technological developments and craft their legislation or craft their decisions to anticipate those, but instead you ask pretty basic, you know, straightforward questions, as the court did here. You know, who's broadcasting what to whom, and what's your relationship to that content in terms of determining whether a license is required or not. As a basic matter, from a policy standpoint, I think true innovation comes when companies are incentivized to spend their energies developing products and services that are, you know, bringing technology forward in an efficient manner, in a consumer-friendly manner, and where they're also compensating creators for the work that they broadcast to audiences, rather than putting them in a place where they're, you know, trying to figure out how to find loopholes in the law and get around taking licenses for work, which ultimately, you know, ends up with technologies that are suboptimal in terms of delivering the work to audiences. I think the questions that were asked and the analysis that the court gives us are pretty straightforward. If you remove the gloss of the cable comparisons from the top of it, and I think the cable comparisons were a useful way for the court to get into it. But really, what the court was saying was, you know, you're doing essentially what everybody else pays to do, and you should be treated just like every other technology company, every other broadcaster who takes a license for this type of an activity.
Thanks. Anyone else want to comment on what it means for the video marketplace, or even perhaps what it means for Aereo specifically? The title of the panel suggested that this was a death sentence for Aereo. Is it in fact a death sentence, or does Aereo have some options going forward?
David, can I? Matt. So, by the way, let me say thanks to the Internet Caucus for setting this up. I think this is both timely and really useful. So, I think reports of Aereo's death are probably premature. The case is pretty clear that it only speaks to real-time television, and there is a lot of other functionality which other providers are already offering in the online marketplace, which could be explored here. But certainly, with respect to the real-time feature that was an issue in this case, it's probably a death sentence for that feature. I don't know that I'd say that's a death sentence for the company, although it's by no means an encouraging opinion. I actually think it's a maybe in a broader sense a death sentence for interest in investing in the development of services that touch content. I mean, you have to imagine we have this rule where Aereo had a strong case that it was in compliance with the law, and what it was told by the court is, notwithstanding that, we're not going to look under the hood of your technology. We're not going to pay any attention to how the technology really works. We're just going to say it looks like cable, and therefore we're going to regulate it like cable. And the problem is that it's hard to advise clients on a sort of how to comply with an I know it when I see it rule. Right? If they're going to say I know cable when I see it, well, you know, if you're going to be a service provider that has video, you need to know that some federal judge in the future isn't going to tell you that you look like what that judge thinks cable is, and therefore you're liable. You know, another way to say it is that one man's legal compliance is another man's loophole, and you don't want to invest billions of dollars and then find out that, well, you thought you were copyright compliant, but you were only loophole compliant, and therefore you're on the hook for statutory damages.
Thanks, Matt. Anyone else have any thoughts on this point?
I do, but I don't want to monopolize the conversation. I guess I would say that it underscores the need not to look for loopholes, but instead to come up with real business strategies and real technology development plans that really benefit both consumers and the tech company and the creator of the content simultaneously. I mean, I think it demonstrates the importance of having an acquisition plan for how you're going to acquire quality content for your service. Netflix and other really popular consumer services are investing a lot of money both in developing their own programming and in acquiring programming through legitimate services, and those are the sorts of services that you really see thriving in the marketplace. And so I think that just underscores that the best work migrates to where it's compensated, and if you don't have a plan for compensating people for the work that they create and that you broadcast, I think your business plan is going to suffer if you're, relying on being able to find work for free someplace.
So for Aereo itself, is that the potential path forward? Is it seeking licenses in the market and trying to act more precisely as the other cable systems act, or to focus on any other avenues forward for Aereo itself?
I'll offer one thought if no one else will. I don't want to monopolize either. I do think there's an interesting question left open by the opinion as to whether or not, if one looks like a cable company, one can actually get the licenses written for cable companies. You know, we've seen cases in the past where online video services have said, well, I want to get a cable company license, and they were told, well, no, because you don't fit these exact specific parameters of the statute. But if we're going to apply if it looks like cable, it's cable, then perhaps we could see people seeking to acquire these compulsory licenses for that were originally drafted for sort of standard cable TV networks. And that might actually introduce some competition in the marketplace. But, again, I think what we're a lot likelier to see is investors, directing money away from services that are touching content because they don't want to get, drawn into that morass.
I'll just add to that. In terms of whether online services like Aereo can qualify for the compulsory license, that is really an issue for which the ball is in the FCC's court at this point, because the impediment there is that the agency has issued regulations saying that the compulsory license doesn't apply to content delivered over the internet. So that is what would have to change in order to take for services like Aereo to become licensed.
And does that need an FCC rule change, or is that a matter for
it
Congress?
Congress could obviously change it, but the FCC ruled that, and then the Second Circuit upheld the FCC's ruling in a case called the IVI case.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's turn to some of the broader implications. One of them I mentioned, that Aereo had tried hard to rely on a 2008 case involving Cablevision's remote DVR service. This is a service that would function like a digital video recorder or a TiVo, but would actually record programs on servers in the company's facilities instead of in a black box sitting on top of the user's television, and then stream them back to users on demand. So where does the Aereo decision leave the Cablevision DVR case and the idea of remote DVRs generally? Is there any clarity on that?
I'm definitely happy to answer that. I should clarify first.
Start with Robert and then go to James.
So our firm and myself have represented Cablevision since the 2007 decision. I'm here, though, in my individual capacity rather than speaking for our client. But, obviously this is a question both our client and we have given a lot of thought about. As we read the decision, it does not map on exactly to the Second Circuit's reasoning and what it said upholding the RSDVR back in 2008. But in terms of where it ends up, we view it as very consistent. What the distinction the Supreme Court draws is between, on the one hand, services that deliver content over a cable system or over a satellite system, and on the other hand, services that just allow consumers to record or store their own content, which they can do lawfully, and then play that content back to themselves. And the way that the Supreme Court phrases that in Aereo is this concept of being a possessor of a work that you have a prior relationship to. And so, that covers situations where if you buy a MP3 file off of Amazon's MP3 store, and then put it in the cloud, like say on Amazon's Cloud Player or some other remote service like that, and then play it back to yourself, nobody would say either before or after Aereo that that's a public performance and that Amazon needs a public performance license just to let you play back your own recording to yourself. And I think that's what the Supreme Court was getting at when it said that language. And as we view it, the RSDVR is exactly the same thing. Under the Sony case, consumers have a right to make recordings of television programs to watch at a later time. They've done that with VCRs for decades. They've done it with set-top DVRs. And the RSDVR is really just the same recording and playback service, just with remote storage. And so when an RSDVR subscriber is recording something and playing it back, that's content he already had a lawful right to receive through his cable subscription, so it's something he's already paid for. And all he's doing with the RSDVR is then storing that content, becoming the possessor of it, if you will, the way the Supreme Court referred to it in Aereo, and then playing back that content he already had a lawful relationship to. And so we view that language in the Supreme Court's opinion as saying that even though we're going to say Aereo looks like a cable system, has to get a get permission the same way somebody would to operate a cable or satellite system, different services where you're just allowing consumers to record or store their own content and then play it back aren't public performances. Those are private performances.
James, any thoughts on that question?
Yeah, I agree that the decision can be read in a way that would continue to protect Cablevision's art remote DVR because there it already has a license to the content, albeit for a slightly different use, but the customers aren't relying on the device to get them their initial access. They get that through Cablevision and then ask Cablevision to make them a copy. Unfortunately, the part of the decision that Statebrook bears on this is quite obscure and quite inartfully drafted because the owner or possessor of a work language is... it's a very odd thing to say about copyrighted works, which are intangible. You can't hold a song in your hand. You can hold a copy of it. You could hold an iPod on which the song has been stored, but you never possess a song itself. So you could take that language and read it to say that where the consumer has lawfully achieved access to the work through some other means, they continue to have the ability to store it on a personal device or to have somebody store it for them on their behalf, like uploading it to Dropbox in the cloud. But the decision creates some uncertainty in that respect, and it's already being cited in litigation against consumer electronics. For the proposition that consumers who make recordings on devices in their homes and then stream the video to themselves, the maker of that device has been accused of publicly performing. This is the Dish case. And Aereo could be read in a way that suggests that by giving consumers a box that they then use to record things, you are now stepping in and taking an active role in it so that you'll be held liable.
Matt. Yeah, so I want to agree with everything. I agree with everything James just said, and I actually want to agree with everything that Robert said, or in other words, I think that all should be the outcome, but reading the decision, I'm not sure that it is. In other words, I think, you know, the Sony notion that you can record video that you're lawfully entitled to have and then watch it yourself later should still be a defining characteristic of American copyright law. And I also think that streaming stuff to yourself that you lawfully have a license to should still be a defining characteristic of American copyright law. It's just that it's not really clear that it is. And James was pointing to this language in the opinion that says, oh, well, if you're an owner or possessor of it, you're okay. But the problem is, of course, you don't own or possess your iTunes. You're a licensee of them. And, you know, you click that little buy button in iTunes, but you're really not buying it. And it wouldn't be good marketing to have a green square that said license, right? And you press the license button. You're like, well, I just licensed that song, right? So we use the word buy because it's kind of good marketing. But really, we're all just licensees. And so what does this language really mean? It's not really clear. It's a great example of why the baggage of the physical property metaphor for intellectual property, for real property used in the intellectual property context, causes problems, right? So they use that language coming off this metaphor where they're talking about a car and whether you valet park a car, and that sort of drives the thinking. And so they're thinking about owning or possessing a car. But of course, You know, if you are driving your car, I can't drive it at the same time. Our sort of use of your car is rivalrous, but we could both have a license to a copy of a song, and my use doesn't diminish your use and vice versa. And so you try and take this real property metaphor and map it onto the goods, and you wind up with this language that, I'm sorry, you try and map it onto the copyrighted work, and you wind up with this language that sounds like we're talking about goods, and it's not clear what it means. I think it should be interpreted to mean, I think, what we're saying, but there's great ambiguity, and as we've already seen, it's already, this principle has already been cited against DISH in an ongoing litigation.
I mean, just weighing in on that, I mean, admittedly, the owner or possessor of the work is not the clearest choice of words I think Justice Breyer could have made, but on the other hand, if you're deciding how to interpret that ambiguous language, you have to do that in the context of the arguments that were made in the case. I mean, nobody was arguing there was any dispute about transmitting content back to the owner of the copyright. I mean, that's clearly not what the case was talking about. And so if you reject that, I don't see what you can read that language to mean other than situations where somebody has a lawful recording or copy of a work, whether that's because he bought a song off of Amazon's MP3 store or made a lawful recording with a service like the RSDVR. I mean, I just don't know what other plausible interpretation of that admittedly not very well phrase thing is. Those were the cloud technologies that everyone was telling the court, you know, don't touch those, whatever you do with Aereo, protect these sorts of cloud technologies. And so even if the opinion didn't do the best job of articulating that phrasing in the right copyright terminology, I mean, I just don't know how else or what else that could plausibly mean.
So just to weigh in on this discussion, I think the analysis that Robert's put forward is probably correct on the owner-possessor issue. I think the area where there may be some concern if you're an RSDVR manufacturer would be the fact that you're still potentially trying to stand in the shoes of the consumer to argue that you're entitled to take advantage of the consumer's fair use right to make those recordings. And so I think that's something that the court has never actually ruled on in the context of a service rather than someone who's purely an equipment provider. That issue wasn't presented to the court to rule on in Cablevision by agreement of the parties, and that's actually something that the dissent sort of comments on here in Aereo, saying, you know, we could have had a secondary liability case here and, you know, argued some of these fair use issues that it seems the court really might have liked to get into, but you didn't do that. And so I think that's really where the next debate lies is how far do some of these defenses to copyright infringement that belong to the user, you know, extend? Can a commercial service stand in the shoes and commercialize that sort of a personal defense?
And I'll weigh in on that, too. I mean, there is definitely apart from the public performance issues in Aereo, there is also an issue of the reproduction right in cases where you have a recording and playback service. The issue that was presented in Cablevision was who is doing the reproduction, because if it is the consumer that's the one making the copies, then it is absolutely clear under the law that a service provider can't be held secondarily liable for that as long as the consumer has a fair use right. And the reason is if the consumer is doing the copying but the consumer has a fair use right to do that, then there's no active infringement that the service provider can be contributing to. And so really what the argument would, I mean, if you accept the ruling that Cablevision said on reproduction, which hasn't been called into question certainly by Aereo, you know, the only argument that's left would be that somehow consumers have a fair use right to record stuff for later viewing if they use a VCR, they have a right to do it if they use a set-top DVR, but somehow they don't have a right to do it if they use a DVR on the cloud. And I've never heard any reason why fair use rights would come out any differently depending on whether you use remote storage or local storage, especially from the consumer's perspective.
So I want to take this up to like 40,000 feet. Like a lot of you folks not steeped in this issue might be thinking, like, I thought I came to a panel about Aereo and these people are all talking about this Cablevision case. Like, what, did I come into the wrong room? So Cablevision, you know, was strictly speaking about a remote DVR, right? Taking the TiVo off your TV and putting it in the cable company's headquarters. But the reasoning of the opinion was the foundation for a lot of the cloud services that we use today. Some research that we commissioned from Josh Lerner at Harvard about the economic impact of that showed that in the 2.5 years after the Cablevision case, between $750 million and $1.3 billion in investment capital went into cloud services because of the certainty that that decision created. And so people said, wow, like we can now offer all these cool services, let's start doing things. And you saw a lot of competition, you know, before maybe there was just Dropbox, but then you saw more and more services being rolled out with additional features, you know, Microsoft SkyDrive, iCloud, Google Drive, all these things got more features, more robust, more competition, and now you have tons of cloud storage services that are available to you. So this decision was hugely important, and one of the reasons why so many people are concerned about Aereo is not about television, although, you know, that's an important marketplace, but about the cloud. And indeed, my principal concern about Aereo all along was how is this going to affect the cloud because of the Cablevision provision. And what we've seen is a decision that is silent about the Cablevision rule. And that silence is deafening. I mean, I want to read this decision to say, well, the cloud's okay. But there is one parenthetical reference to the Cablevision decision in this. And so, I mean, I want Cablevision's RSDVR to still be lawful, but it's not clear to me that it is.
So, Matt, just on that point, it's true that the decision doesn't refer specifically to the Cablevision decision. The opinion certainly does refer to the concerns that were raised about cloud computing, and the court itself says that it views its holding as limited and narrow. Is there a reading of this, that this is really a very limited, narrow case?
Well, yes, and I'll tell you, as soon as one of my members gets sued, my litigation position is that this is a really narrow opinion. But look, I mean, the fact of the matter is, if you read the dissent, it says, yes, the majority is telling you this is a super narrow opinion, but they can't deliver on that promise, right? The majority is writing checks it can't cash. And we've already seen, you know, we've already seen it getting invoked in sort of similar consumer electronics litigation. So there's also language in the majority opinion that says we're not passing on other technologies. So, you know, I'll tell you the ways that I want to interpret the opinion, but the fact is that there are competent counsel that are going to file lawsuits and offer competing interpretations.
Let me take this up from 40,000 feet maybe to 60,000. One of the reasons that we are having this debate here and that you have the debate between the majority and the dissent is the problem of technical convergence. You have computers which can do an enormous number of things, and so they can build systems that look a lot like a cable system. You can use them to transmit audio over the internet that looks a lot like radio. You can use them to send text around. You're substituting for publishers. You can use them to store things. You have an enormous number of uses. And the underlying technology to do all of these is actually incredibly similar, so that when you start trying to say, what are we going to treat cable systems this way and radio this way and VCRs and DVRs this way, you get into very hard categorization problems, because the same system, take Dropbox, it can be made to look like a video on demand service that's unlicensed. It can be made to look like storage lockers. It can be made to look like a lot of different things by using it in slightly different ways. So Matt is concerned that he will have members who are building general purpose technologies and get sued because one of the uses is like something we've regulated in a particular way that we shouldn't be trying to do. And the question is going to be, can we preserve these distinctions, or do we need to drop back to simpler ones that say certain kinds of general systems are okay and certain kinds of dedicated infringement devices are not, if we can even draw that line?
I guess I would say litigators say bad facts make bad law. And so if you go into a case saying, you know, okay, I don't think I'm going to qualify under the straight language of the statute, and so I'm going to say, look over here, I'm like a cloud system, you know, don't do bad things to cloud systems, and you end up, you know, with an outcome that then makes your colleagues in a trade association concerned that you're going to do bad things to a cloud system, that's, you know, a poor result that you've brought on yourself by the litigation strategy you've chosen. I think that's not the result that needs to have happened here. I think the court actually does give you a fairly narrow ruling. The court takes pains to say that it's given a limited ruling that it doesn't intend to extend to cloud systems. It says, you know, that the history of cable transmissions led to the enactment of the transmit clause that it's talking about here, and it isn't sure whether other types of broadcasters and transmitters would lead it to the same conclusion that it performs. And it, you know, talks about the definition of public and talks about the fact that the public doesn't include those who are owners or possessors of the relevant product, and also that, you know, they haven't analyzed whether the public performance right is implicated where the user is paying primarily to store something, you know, in the cloud for themselves rather than to transmit copyrighted work, you know, to themselves, and that it, you know, the public definition doesn't come into play if you're transmitting only to people who are within the context of your family and your, you know, close circle of friends. So I think what the court is doing is giving you all the traditional copyright analysis around what constitutes a public performance, pointing you back to that path and saying, look, we know what Aereo was doing was a public performance. We are getting away from the very complicated and convoluted tests that the Second Circuit had given us to a much more straightforward reading of the law, and asking, you know, what are you doing to whom, and what is your relationship to that content? And those are the sorts of easy questions that a court can ask going forward, and that a service can ask going forward when analyzing its potential risk of liability, that I think they can ask far more easily than the tests that the Second Circuit had given us in the lower court opinion.
I'll speak to that. I mean, I don't know that it is true that the Second Circuit's test was more complicated or harder to apply than the Supreme Court's test, but whatever you think about the route they get somewhere, there is, and I think in the industry for a long time, has been an understanding that there's a basic difference between a service on the one hand that takes a library of content, like, you know, for example, certain TV channels or certain movies, and offers to transmit those to anyone that's willing to sign up for its service through a video on demand service or through a cable or a satellite content delivery system. And on the other hand, a service that just lets consumers take content that they have already lawfully acquired from somewhere else, whether because they bought it off an MP3 store or because they recorded it off their cable subscription, and just provides them a mechanism for playing that content back to themselves. And the Second Circuit gave one rationale that distinguishes between those two types of systems. The Supreme Court gave a slightly different one, but at the end of the day, I mean, I think the industry and courts understand that there's a basic difference between those two types of systems, and I don't read anything in the Supreme Court's opinion as giving a lot of ammunition to people that want to say that, no, those should be treated the same.
So one fact that didn't show up in the Supreme Court's opinion, but the broadcasters made a lot out of, was that Aereo marketed itself saying, watch live TV. And that's the headline on their homepage. Given that, they were really positioning themselves as a consumer alternative to cable. Something like the RSDVR is positioned as an alternative to the set-top box DVR you have in your home. And even if they're actually technologically very, very similar, that market positioning, I think, has influenced how the courts have responded to them, and it might influence what we think is legitimate.
I do think the court was influenced by that marketing, and I think even the dissent says Aereo is doing something that we don't think it should be able to do under the copyright laws. They disagree with the majority opinion's, you know, analysis and how they get to that result, but I think even the dissent is saying this feels incorrect to us, you know, for a variety of reasons. And I think the reason why the majority opinion actually asks the question of what's your relationship with the content is to get to that issue of are you portraying yourself as a broadcaster of copyrighted content, or are you somebody who is a storage device? And I think that's a very common sense way to distinguish between perhaps an RSDVR on one hand or a cloud service, on one hand, and a service like Aereo on the other.
So I think Sandra's characterization was that Aereo sort of showed up and did a lot of hand-waving about the cloud. And that's really not the way this went down. In fact, the way it went down is that Aereo was accused of having an overly technical legal rationale for its service. And the hand waving, to be blunt, was really on the other side. People saying, "Well, this kind of looks like cable, and therefore their legal rationale notwithstanding, they should be treated like cable." And that won out, right? And that's very concerning because, as I said, you have what appears to be a legally compliant service, and then it turns out that you're only compliant with the loophole. You're not compliant with the compliance, and therefore you're in trouble. And it is an outcome that is frankly very antithetical to a lot of the disruptive innovations we've seen in recent years, where just because Uber kind of looks like taxis, we don't require them all to get medallions, and just because Airbnb kind of looks like the hospitality industry, they don't have to go through all that regulation, and just because food trucks kind of look like restaurants, they don't all have to, there is a lot of new ways to offer other services, and until the regulatory apparatus changes to encompass those things, which it can, right, there's nothing to prevent municipalities from sort of reaching out to specifically regulate, transportation services ordered by smartphone, right? But what you don't do is the dissent in this case is what you don't do is you don't sort of stretch the existing regulatory apparatus to encompass something new because you think it looks like it's been drafted outside the regulatory apparatus. Because if the apparatus grows every time somebody looks like they're trying to get outside of it, you never know when you're in it or out of it.
I mean, speaking to that, there is a regulatory apparatus that can change. I think I said before it was FCC rules, but it's Copyright Office rules that say that transmissions over the internet aren't a cable system. And so if Aereo's system is good, those rules should get changed. Aereo should be allowed to provide that service, and it should pay the same licensing fees that a cable system or a satellite system does. And that's not a case of, changing the statute to cover something it doesn't. It's a case where you have a statute that probably has some ambiguity around the edges, and in interpreting whether it's going to apply to a given system or not, I think it's legitimate for a court to say, what would Congress have intended here? If we have an ambiguous statute as to whether it covers a system like Aereo's, it's relevant that the service Aereo's providing is functionally identical to what a cable system or a satellite system provides when it delivers content. And so I don't think that was an illegitimate method of reasoning for the court to undertake here. And that said, I agree that there's nothing sort of inherently wrong with advising your clients to structure their system in a certain way so that it falls within existing precedent. On the other hand, if you have statutes that are ambiguous around the edges and you try and come as close as you can to the edge, you sort of take the risk that a court is going to disagree with you about whether Congress wanted to cover your system or not. And at the end of the day, I think that's sort of what happened to Aereo here.
This is the kind of a classic theory about regulation, right, is that there's laws, and then laws have these sort of ambiguous penumbras, and you need to ensure that not only are you compliant with the law, but you're not anywhere near the penumbra, and nobody knows where the penumbra is, and that sort of deters a lot of potential innovation and directs money towards investment in areas where there are fewer penumbras. But I do think, it is true that there could be a construction of the cable system whereby the cable regs whereby Aereo could have gotten could get a license, right? But had they asked their lawyers in 2012, hey, can we do this? Their lawyers would have and may well have said, well, no, there was just this case that says that even though you kind of look like a cable system, you have to do this, and you don't comply. Therefore, you can't get the license. Even if you want to pay the money, you can't pay the money. So forget about being a cable system. Right now, I think that outcome might not stand today. But that was the rule that they were operating under in 2012.
So I just want to remind people that we're talking about copyright law here, which exists to compensate creators of creative works to encourage them to create those works and to disseminate them to the public. And so, you know, let's not get lost in talking about over-regulating industries. I mean, the bottom line here is that it is appropriate to compensate people who put their life and blood and soul into creating these works. If you are using those works to drive your service and you're using those works to, you know, sell to your subscribers. So that's kind of the whole, you know, issue that this this case was premised on. And so for the court to say, look, you are in fact doing the same sort of thing that everybody else pays for, I think that's a pretty rational conclusion to come to. And, you know, I don't think that it is something that we should be losing a lot of sleep over, that, you know, a loophole has been, you know, has turned out not to be a loophole in the copyright law. I think that's a healthy result. It's a healthy result for creativity. It's a healthy result for startups because it puts everybody on a level playing field and says, you know, don't spend your efforts looking for loopholes. Spend your efforts designing great new technologies. Work cooperatively with the creative community. Work cooperatively to get new services out there that compete head-to-head with existing services. There are plenty of services that are doing just that.
Let me echo that a bit and take maybe a view from orbit, which is, in the long run, we're all dead, and in the long run, so is broadcasting. That as a means, it's very important right now. Broadcasting and cable are ways in which many Americans get video. But video is just images and sounds in sequence, and delivering that wirelessly through individual devices, through local towers, and delivering that through wired internet connections is, in the long run, a much higher bandwidth and much more adaptable way of doing it. We are going to see a transition, and it will happen both regulatorily and as creators and distributors make market decisions, to have the creators of video content switch to selling it to users over the internet in all kinds of packages with all kinds of bundles. You'll have channels, you'll have networks, you will have collections, you'll have individual rentals, you'll have individual sales. And we won't rely on a tower streaming the same exact content to millions of people, most of whom aren't watching it. So this is very high stakes in the short run as we think about existing industries. But we are in the middle of a long transition by which broadcasters and content companies get out of the streaming stuff over the airwaves business and into other distribution models.
So as you think about those long-term implications, I guess it's worth asking then, as we sit here in the shadow of Congress, what's Congress's role in all that? There were a few reactions to the case on Wednesday. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Bob Goodlatte said that the decision reinforces the importance of reviewing copyright law. Energy and Commerce Chair Fred Upton said the case underscores the mounting need to modernize the 80-year-old Communications Act. Energy and Commerce Ranking Member Eshoo said that the court's decision is a reminder that our video laws are broken and in need of reform. So lots of people looking at this saying it maybe carries some long-run implications for Congress. What lessons should Congress take from this decision? And are there some problems here that merit congressional attention, either in the short run or ultimately for a longer-term overhaul?
My response to that would be that if the Supreme Court had come down saying Aereo is lawful, or if the Supreme Court had come down saying Aereo is unlawful but had done it in a way that actually genuinely threatens cloud technologies of a sort that haven't historically been thought to require a license, those sorts of calls for some sort of legislative response would be a lot better placed and a lot better likely to inspire action. The way the Supreme Court came down, yeah, there might be a little bit of residual ambiguity, but I don't think it's dramatically at odds with the industry's expectations about, you know, how this case should have come out and how cloud technology should be treated. So, you know, we'll see, but that would be my initial take.
In the short run, as the dissent points out, the courts have various doctrines, including the common law doctrines of secondary liability and the volitional infringement test that they use to calibrate and keep copyright working. And that system is well established. the majority doesn't reject any of the premises, just their application to ARIO. So in the short run, the courts have the tools to work through this. While I have concerns about some of the unclarity created by the court's language, I'm not sure that congressional intervention on these issues would create less rather than more uncertainty. Looking forward several years down the road, we're already looking at revisions of the Copyright Act. It would be nice to have something that were simpler and clearer without some of the inartful drafting of the transmit clause that made this case necessary. But that's something to take the time to get right rather than rushing to any response to this case.
So there's just I agree with a lot of what James just said. Another sort of detail I'd add to that is the majority here points to the fair use doctrine, presumably invoking the Sony decision from the 80s and saying, well, you know, there's still the fair use doctrine, so you don't have to worry about that. And actually, if you go back to the Golan versus Holder case, you know, the Supreme Court says, well, there's still the fair use doctrine, so you don't have to worry. And then if you even go back to the 2003 Eldred decision, the court says, well, there's still the fair use doctrine. So every time we have these cases that sort of apply pressure on technology, the cases, you've always got an opinion saying, well, don't worry, we've still got the fair use doctrine. And then, you know, when I see a lot of my members in cases and they're invoking the fair use doctrine, you see people complaining about it, saying, well, the fair use creep. Well, you know, I mean, we've had Supreme Court after Supreme Court saying, you know, the fair use doctrine is very important. And so I think this just underscores how important that is. And so in this Dish case that we were talking about, you know, the fair use doctrine is going to be very important. The HathiTrust book scanning case, also a very important fair use decision. The fair use doctrine is being required to do more and more work in our copyright system, and it's just another example of why it's become incredibly important for so many different constituencies, including technology, but not limited to them. And I think that's a trend that we're going to see. And you know, as in 2013, there were a number of very prominent victories for defendants that invoked the fair use doctrine. And I think we're going to keep seeing that become an increasingly important aspect of our copyright statute.
So I agree with what Robert has said, and I agree actually with parts of what Matt said. I do think the fair use doctrine is very important. I think it's being asked to do probably too much work, and there's not enough guidance for the courts to figure out how best to apply it and how and in which situations to apply it. And I'm a little nervous that if you put the entirety of, you know, the burden of solving every problem on the fair use doctrine, you really have no, you know, no good roadmap to follow as to how cases will come out or how to approach any given situation. I don't think that at the moment there's likely to be a lot of pressure to make a specific adjustment as a result of this ruling legislatively. But to the extent that there would be a need to make an adjustment, I would urge for people to come with specific proposals rather than to simply say, oh, well, we'll let fair use deal with that, because I think for sake of clarity, both on the user side and on the copyright owner side, there's just not a heck of a lot of predictability. And on the copyright owner side, fair use is an incredibly important doctrine in terms of dealing with how works are exploited and how works are built upon and used in different contexts. And I don't want those important aspects of the doctrine to kind of get shoved aside because it's expanded to do all of these other important things that it maybe wasn't initially intended to do in such a robust way.
So I have a few more questions we could delve into, but I do want to leave time for the audience. So let me ask at this time if there are folks in the audience who have questions they'd like to pose about the case. David. Anyone want to respond to that?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm not sure I agree with the construction that Grokster didn't have negative consequences. Still, in the wake of Grokster, when you see copyright complaints filed, generally speaking, the plaintiff will allege direct liability, indirect liability, and when they allege indirect, they allege vicarious, contributory, and inducement. Right, because people still can't figure out if Grokster means that inducement is just a refinement of contributory or if it's another one. So you're getting, we've still got like a whole new cause of action in there. We're not even sure if it exists, right? Because it's sort of like, the Schrodinger's cat of pleading. We want to make sure if it's dead or alive, we still got both. So we claim both, and we'll just figure out later which one is the actual theory, right? So there's ambiguity in that sense. And the impact of that is that you have, I think, counsels advising about, you know, don't do things that might look like inducement, but don't do things that might look like contributory. And I also think there's been a lot of literature suggesting that the investment in that space is depressed by uncertainty about what kind of conduct might get you in trouble for other people's infringement. And I know Professor Michael Carrier has done a lot of writing about the consequences of depressed investment in an area where legal certainty is lacking.
I will say that from our perspective, what Grokster does show is that secondary liability a lot of times is the appropriate way to address some of these questions. And because an argument you often hear is that, oh, the volition test is terrible because how can you avoid copyright law just by automating your service and making it all consumer-initiated, and therefore, you know, the volition test just can't possibly be right. And the Grokster case is an effective response to that because it shows that even where you've said that a company like Grokster may not be the direct infringer, may not be the one doing the unlawful copying, there's still ample ways to hold them liable under the law if they really just are operating a mechanism for people to violate copyright. And so in that respect, I do think it is helpful, and I do think it also should inform people's thinking about the volition standard for direct infringement and how it can make a lot of sense to define direct infringement relatively narrowly because there are these other Grokster-type doctrines that can appropriately consider copyright owners' rights.
Okay, I have another question in the back. And that goes, I guess, to the question of how broad or narrow ultimately is the impact of this case. Other questions? A question over there?
So I'll try to address that. My first comment when we started the panel was, although I think the discussion in the majority opinion uses cable by way of analogy, what the court is doing is analyzing the transmit clause and saying historically the transmit clause came about because the Congress was basically overruling two decisions that came out in the cable context, and this was the legislative intent of Congress by passing the law that enacted the transmit clause, and you know how we are interpreting the transmit clause. And so they're using cable and the history of cable and what you do as a broadcaster in the cable context to inform their analysis of the legislative history, but they're not saying Aereo is a cable system. They're saying the language of the statute would encompass the activities that Aereo is undertaking as public performances. So I don't think one has a direct relation to the other in terms of saying Aereo now can go and claim to be entitled to treatment as a cable system under FCC definitions of cable systems.
Thinking more broadly, the opinion does give the FCC and the Copyright Office a little bit more license to go adventuring in two respects. One of them is because the majority dissent split is so much about congressional purpose versus text, it might seem to suggest that redefinitions that are consistent with Congress's purpose in the copyright and communications statutes might fare well even when they have to deal with some textual awkwardness. And to the extent that there is textual difficulty, then this becomes a place in which Chevron and deference to agency interpretations of ambiguous statutes might provide some latitude. So I think it's indicative of the court's thinking about this intersection at that very high level about how do we approach statutes, but it probably doesn't have direct bearing on the specific questions of interpreting the cable-specific definitions in the communications side.
Right, and if you look at the statutory licenses, I mean, it's quite a different thing to analyze the transmit clause and then to say, oh, Section 111, all of those, however many, 40 pages of, statutory text, we can just ignore that. I don't think the court would ever go there based on this opinion.
Right. I mean, in past practice, when they wanted to expand the cable license to cover satellite systems, I mean, they enacted legislation and additional sections that covered that. And I completely agree that it's one thing to say, are you the equivalent of a cable system when you are interpreting statutory language that just refers generically to public performances? It's another thing to it would be an additional step past that to say that statutory licenses specifically covering cable systems should cover other types of technologies.
So the opinion specifically does cite the Section 111 compulsory license for cable companies, and this is the one part of the majority that I really agree with because it characterizes it as a complex, highly detailed compulsory licensing scheme that's under which cable systems may retransmit broadcasts. So that's how they refer to Section 111. And then in deciding that Aereo is like a cable company, it says
the many similarities between Aereo and cable companies, considered in light of Congress's basic purpose in amending the Copyright Act, convince us that this difference, the sort of technology difference that Aereo had pointed to, is not critical here. And so we conclude that Aereo is not just an equipment supplier and that Aereo performs like a cable system. So to me, that seems to be saying Aereo's a cable system. Now, I acknowledge there's the question of, are they a cable system under the Copyright Act, and are they an MVPD under the Communications Act, is two very different questions. But it would seem really strange to me to have had, you know, a couple years ago, an online video system, IVI, says, okay, hey, we're a cable system, and someone points to the very fine text and says, no, you're not. And the Aereo says, okay, well, I guess we're not a cable system, and so they proceed with their service, and then we have the Supreme Court say, oh, yes, you are. Well, now if they go back and they say, okay, well, I guess we're a cable system, to have someone say, well, no, you're not. It's sort of like, well, which shell is the ball under? Right. I mean, either they are or they aren't. It's sort of every time you're a cable system only when you don't want to be, and when you do want to be, you're not. It would seem like a very unfair rule.
So what the court said was Aereo performs, which is the word that they're defining for purposes of this litigation, not Aereo is a cable system. So the question is, what does perform mean? And that's what this case was all about, not is Aereo a cable system.
Other questions? Well, let me ask one more. So again, at kind of a high level, what does this case say about the relevance of technical details, of looking under the hood when courts are approaching technology cases? I think we've heard some discussion of that, about how certainly in this case the court said it wasn't going to put a lot of weight on the technical details of how Aereo's system works. Is that consistent with how copyright law has traditionally operated? Has copyright law traditionally actually cared a fair amount about the technical details of how systems work? To what extent is the court's approach here consistent with or kind of a departure from what either the history is or what we think the right approach would be in terms of how much to look at the technical operation of a system when analyzing it versus how much to look at the broad functional characteristics or the way it's marketed, which is something else we've touched on?
So, I mean, the Copyright Act hasn't been fully revised all that often. And in 1976, when these provisions were enacted, the last time that the Congress had, you know, fully looked at the Act was in 1909. So they were looking back and saying, and there are briefs, amicus briefs, examining legislative history at that point that make this point. And saying, look, we realize that this isn't something we do all the time. We need to kind of future-proof our legislation and make sure that the statute, is workable in the future. And so we want a technology-neutral statute. And so I think the fact that the court interpreted the transmit clause as it did is taking account of that legislative history and that line of argument, and it's fully consistent with how Congress has historically treated the copyright laws, and it's, I think, the practical way to treat the copyright laws, because it is very difficult to keep up with developments in technology, and I think it's not a smart thing to try and legislate or regulate on a technology-by-technology basis, but a far better approach to have a overarching principle like people who, create the works that you're broadcasting deserve to be compensated for those works so that they continue to create those works. Regardless of the technology that you use to transmit those works, the same rule applies. If you have a very kind of broad-based principle like that that applies to all comers, then everybody is treated similarly, and they can distinguish themselves in the marketplace by building better, more creative services and competing on those grounds rather than on having to, figure out ways around the law. And neither Congress nor the courts then need to keep up with every advancement in technology and, get advanced engineering and computer science degrees to understand what's happening before they legislate or rule in a particular case.
Well, yeah, so I mean, I think the sense of treating likes alike has an appeal, provided you sort of know who you are ahead of time, right? But it's sort of funny to see the Supreme Court saying, well, we should have a sort of, if A looks like B, we should regulate A like B approach, when the Copyright Act famously doesn't do that. I mean, this committee just had, the Judiciary Committee just had its second of two hearings on music licensing. And, you know, at the very minute this case is being handed down, the committee's hearing how broadcast radio doesn't pay for performances of sound recordings, right? And then satellite radio, they pay, right? Because it's satellite, not broadcast. Now they pay one standard. And then internet radio, which was the latest to the party, they pay under an even different standard, right? It's all radio. But depending on whether you get your radio by the internet, satellite, or terrestrial, right, they're all treated differently. Right? So now I don't think that's a particularly good outcome. I don't think it's desirable that internet radio, which is sort of the newest technology, has the worst deal of the three. And that technological neutrality is probably a good way to encourage that the best technology wins. Right? That's probably the right way to do things. That's not how we do things. So it's sort of strange to see an opinion that one could say, well, if A looks like B, we should regulate A like B, when that's just not how we do copyright law. And it might be great if we did, but we're not doing it right now.
So you're referring to statutory licenses rather than core definitions in the Copyright Act, and the case and the definitions that were at issue here are core definitions in the Copyright Act that apply to everybody uniformly rather than to particular industries that were negotiated over time under very particular circumstances and that are being also debated very hotly now. And I agree with you also that everybody should be treated equally and that every creative person should be paid for their creative work in the music sector as well.
The Copyright Act is notoriously schizophrenic between, do we have clear, simple, broad principles, or do we have detailed specifications that look at the internals? You have very broad principles when you talk about originality and what's copyrighted. You have very broad statements about fair use, which the courts have filled in. But then you have specific compromises worked out in many situations that spell out quite detailed rules for particular kinds of works, like music works and sound recordings, or for particular uses, like cable and satellite and the intricacies of for sale being different for software and for music than for other kinds of works. You have enormous mess there. Speaking very generally, the latter kind, the detailed compromises, may work at one point in time, but they get increasingly contentious and brittle as time passes, and the initial conditions that led to that compromise change and the players who are in the room change. It's a difficult problem because you want to entrench some of those compromises, but they don't always hold up very well.
Robert, anything you want to add on that, or if not?
No, I'll just say that, you know, the functional versus under the hood approach, it's important not to overgeneralize because, for example, it's clear that if you have a copy shop, it makes a world of difference whether you have human employees that make copies of documents for the customers that come in, or if you just provide self-service photocopying machines that consumers can use to make copies when they come in. And so, you know, there are definitely contexts where those details matter. On the other end of the spectrum, if you have an ambiguous statutory provision, like the transmit clause, I think it makes a lot of good sense to say you are providing a service that is functionally equivalent to what cable systems do, what satellite systems do, and the only difference is you have, you know, rows upon rows of mini antennas rather than one community antenna, and we don't, you know, viewed in terms of Congress's purposes, we're going to interpret the statutory language in light of that. So I don't think it's a either or. I don't think you can draw any huge overarching changes in direction because those are always going to be, you know, different considerations that courts will look at.
Okay. Well, I see we're about at time, so I think I'm going to let that be the last word, and let's say a quick thank you to our panel.